Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
August 9th of 1969 is a date that will indeed, as they say, live in infamy. It was an era that anyone with even a fleeting cognitive recall of that time would be able to immediately recite an address from memory. 10050 Cielo Drive. And for many years to come, they would be able to do so. It was also the site of a second high-profile death of a beautiful actress, one following Jane Mansfield by 2 years and a few days. Only this time, it was murder. As authorities canvassed the residence, they discovered the body of an 18-year-old young man named Stephen Parent, shot to death in a vehicle outside. Parent was actually an unrelated party who just happened to show up at the time of the murders for a completely unrelated issue and lost his life. On the lawn were coffee heiress Abigail Folger and fellow hangabout and socialite Wojtek Wikowski. Both were stabbed to death brutally and without mercy. Inside was famed Hollywood hairstylist and socialite Jay Sabrine. He was shot, stabbed, and lynched with a rope around his neck. But it was the other end of the rope that led to the body of actress Sharon Tate. 8 months pregnant, the wife of Hollywood director Roman Polanski, she too had been stabbed multiple times, with extra attention given to her stomach to make sure that her baby never saw the light of day. Susan Atkins would claim to have zero empathy for her as she killed her later in testimony. The next night, supermarket owners Lino and Rosemary LaBianca were killed in the same fashion. Both crime scenes contained copious amounts of blood and messages written in their blood on the walls and doors in very macabre fashion. Because of this, the world would come to know one name, Charles Manson. Along with his host of followers as this hippie cult that tried to start a race war and show the world the ultimate sum total dark side of the Age of Aquarius. But perhaps no one in the world would find the case more ultimately lucrative than famed Los Angeles prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi, who would write a book that would send all competing narratives into the hinterlands. Or at least that's what he wanted. But did Bugliosi ignore, obfuscate, and occlude peripheral and supporting evidence to avoid altering his prosecutorial narrative? That Manson was simply an uber-intoxicating hippie cult leader that led a murderous racist clan into perdition? Or was something bigger at play here? Tom O'Neill's book, Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA and the Secret History of the 60s, says at least this much, that something isn't right here. We'll discuss this book today at Box Number 7.
Thank you.
Vincent Bugliosi's book, titled Helter Skelter, is the reigning narrative concerning the Tate-LaBianca murders, and no matter what one may think of the ultimate disposition of facts, it was a book that I read as a young man. By the way, not a recommendation I would make to anyone under any circumstances, under 18 years of age at a minimum. The opening line of the book, quote, "It was so quiet," one of the killers would later say, "you could almost hear the sound of ice rattling in the cocktail shakers in the homes way down the canyon," unquote. This would be the operating phrase that would haunt Hollywood, Bel Air, and the Palisades for many years to come. The crime scene photos in the center contained inset narratives and chronological countdowns. Each direct photo of the victim was intact in black and white, minus the body, which was marked as a white silhouette to mercifully deprive the reader of sensory overload. But those white silhouette cutouts have a haunting quality all their own that I cannot really quantify. And imagination is sometimes worse than reality anyway. But it didn't matter. The written testimony of Sabring urging for Tate's life only to be shot, stabbed, and stomped by Tex Watson, and Tate begging for her baby's life as she was being stabbed to death by Susan Atkins was enough to scar the subconscious mind for a lifetime. Bugliosi knew how to tell a story, and he earned 50 lifetimes worth of money telling that story, and in the middle of it, he placed a hero. Himself, surgically building the case that this satanic mob of stabbers were of sound but evil mind, and that their predations were so clear and defined that a death penalty slam dunk would not only symbolically signify a defeat for the anarchists, but also put prosecutor Bugliosi on an adjudicated Mount Olympus and make his written account the biggest selling true crime book of all time. Tom O'Neill's book makes the case that things were far messier and far more complex and even potentially planned in some fashion. And that a secret U.S. government program known as MKUltra might have played little more than an indirect part in this. O'Neill started off over 20 years ago when he was supposed to simply write a magazine article commensurate with the 30th anniversary of the killings. All was going to plan, but he realized when speaking with Vincent Bugliosi as a matter of his, procedural process that Bugliosi contained a distinctly vicious and subtly threatening undertone about anyone questioning the official narrative, that his account, his straight-line prosecutorial workflow, and surface facts in the case were not to be disputed ever under threat of litigation and, I guess, the subtle implication of something even worse than that. Whatever the case, no deviation was going to be tolerated by Bugliosi. That was immediately clear. O'Neill realized that Bugliosi was protesting too much, as they say, and started digging into the case further than he had originally intended. And what was going to be an article with a delayed deadline ultimately turned into a separation from the publication a long time later with nervous publishers, and all of this amid Bugliosi's legal threats, and became a book decades later that would postdate even the death of Bugliosi himself. In short, Bugliosi had no use for a narrative that included hallucinogenic drugs with secondary neuro-linguistic programming and calculated sexual abuse at the core of the murderer's psychological makeup. The primary presence of drugs in the mosaic would have removed the death penalty from the palette of legal options that Bugliosi so desperately needed. The motive needed to be ideologically driven, to leverage racism and hedonism against the public's perception of the hippie movement overall. But they required Bugliosi to ignore and, dare one say, possibly cover up evidence that not only diluted this premise, but potentially implicated other people as potentially guilty of manslaughter by proxy based on either negligence, apathy, or, God forbid, a successful conclusion to some sick experiment conducted by the United States government. Plus, Bugliosi was most likely already writing his book in the heat of the case. Not a great recipe for story arc independence. At the end of the day, there were unanswered questions. Manson's followers presented an almost flatline recollection of their crimes, as if zero emotion or rage had been at the core of what were vicious sociopathic murders. But how could an emotionless person stab Abigail Folger so many times that her white nightgown appeared red on the front lawn and have almost no emotional investment in it? How could a diminutive, 5'2" and seemingly schizophrenic parolee literally command a small fleet of humans to unquestionably commit these horrific atrocities without protest, hesitation, or reticence? O'Neill's book goes a long way to, while not directly proving, but impeccably speculating that Manson was arguably a proximate practitioner of a series of dehumanizing experiments funded by the CIA, unwittingly or otherwise, and the killings were possibly an experiment that went into the successful column in the most perverse of fashions. As O'Neill pours through the files and tapes, he manages to cross paths with people who freeze up suddenly and decide to say nothing or refuse to return his calls. He comes across notes and journal entries that place people at places, and at times it would have destroyed Bugliosi's clean narrative. He even comes across Bugliosi's own notes that unequivocally contradict his own public disclosures in the case, especially when it comes to time frames regarding former Cielo Drive tenant and son of Doris Day, Terry Melcher. That part's a long story, but it matters, and this is why you need to read the book instead of just listen to this podcast or see a current documentary, which I'll mention in a moment. These are all secondary to things that are discovered later, things that defy any claim to an absence of curiosity. Two direct acquaintances of Charles Manson. I should say one direct acquaintance and one indirect acquaintance. The first is Roger Smith, a parole officer in California who was actively curating Manson's parole violations. Manson was supposed to stay in Los Angeles under terms of his restrictions after his release from Terminal Island Prison. He immediately headed for San Francisco, the Northern District, with full knowledge that these authorities could and should have violated his parole, and yet nothing was done. Manson spends the year building a small harem of followers and, in short order, had a completely submissive group of young girls and women in tow. Something like 7 arrests with them later, and Manson and his girls were repeatedly released with no fanfare, no follow-up, no reports, and no consequences. O'Neill attempts to make sense out of the fact that probationary powers to put Manson back in prison were never used, and finds zero rationale as to why they weren't. Is it because he was connected to something higher up the food chain? It sure seems like someone needed him to not be locked up for some inexplicable reason. The second part of this has to do with a CIA officer who was just closing down an MKUltra experiment in San Francisco. He had set up what was essentially a drug house that was making data composition over the use of hallucinogenics, sexual manipulation, and psychological programming. The center was manned by undercover graduate students that grew their hair out and were fronting themselves as hippies and running a hippie crash pad that operated as a medical clinic and ultimate clandestine research center. This center was placed at the heart of the Haight-Ashbury district, which was the same place Manson had set up shop in the months before the killings. Oh, and Roger Smith, the parole officer, the man that should have been arresting Manson for parole violations, directed Manson to the clinic, to the place run by this same operative. The man heading up this research is known as Lewis Jolly West. They called him Jolly, a man verifiably involved in the controversial MKUltra research, literally experiments to see if human beings can be psychologically split into a literal Manchurian candidate, a human drone that can be made to commit any act at the behest of the requester. Jolly West, a man whose clinic was frequented by Manson, had a very significant public role, by the way, previously in 1963, as the man commissioned to meet Jack Ruby in jail after he shot Lee Harvey Oswald, who, after visiting him in the jail, came out for a press conference and proclaimed to the world that Ruby had suddenly had a psychological break and was no use to the legal process. But really, did Jack Ruby suffer a psychological break in the jail while speaking to Lewis Jolly West, or was it his actual break, the one that put an inexplicable bullet into Lee Harvey Oswald, silencing all testimony with regards to the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy? And then was this simply chronologically reframed by the CIA? O'Neill, in his book, says the coincidences and omissions are just too ripe to ignore. And he may be right. The problem is, no amount of research has been able to place Charlie Manson and Jolly West in the same room, not even once. And lips are too tight to say either way. Even though they walked through the same doors of the same place for the same transactions, only for two very apparently different reasons. The fact is, Manson has figured out some way to successfully crank out at least 30 people that would carry out his immediate commands. Was it innate? Was he simply a criminologically magical Svengali that happened to frequent an experimental CIA drug clinic while his parole officer looked the other way while actually telling him to go there, and Vincent Bugliosi just happened to neither care about this nor pursue it in his investigative workflow? Unlikely, it would seem. Manson and West both utilized LSD. Lewis West, in fact, documented in CIA paperwork that he had successfully used LSD to replace genuine memories with false ones in some of his test cases. Manson was able to do the same thing. Only his documentation lay in the pools of blood at three different murder scenes. Both men operated in the same neighborhood at overlapping time frames. Something does stink to high heaven. Ultimately, the CIA program itself was disbanded and almost all the research was destroyed and burned. That's a story for another podcast on another day. O'Neill knows that he can't get his theories very far above the speculative waterline, but he does get close. And his enormously researched book has been somewhat distilled recently in a Netflix documentary called Chaos, The Manson Murders. And while interesting, I'd advise reading the book, as all the connecting tissue and nuances make more sense. Without it, O'Neill, in the documentary, can be very easily dismissed as a kook and a conspiracy theorist independently. And he isn't. Not by a long stretch. And this documentary doesn't go far enough to make these synapses connect, in my opinion, and really treats O'Neill's voluminous research and efforts in a mildly adversarial light to boot. In fact, I don't think the documentary is very good at all by comparison. It just kind of reminds me of somebody's convoluted and, very, very embroidered TikTok mic drop, and that's about it. One interesting thing in the Netflix documentary, though, near the end, Manson himself is seen with a copy of Bugliosi's Helter Skelter, tapping the cover and claiming that he was never allowed to tell the truth on the stand in light of some other narrative, although he never says what that narrative is. Take it for what it's worth, I guess. The problem is, Manson is a terrible primary source. Oh, and he's also dead now, too. O'Neill never claims to prove anything. He simply points to blatant omissions in the evidentiary track. He provides proof of those omissions, makes the connections, and then ultimately asks why. As far as ever being able to prove a larger conspiracy, well, time isn't on Tom O'Neill's side. Not anymore. And as the primary sources of information continue to die off, the secrets may just themselves also decay into oblivion. Right along with the echoes and the baneful cries of Sharon Tate back in August of 1969 in the hills and canyons of Cielo Drive. And this is box number 7.